You ready?
Yes, we are, Mayor.
Okay. So let's go ahead and call the February 25th meeting of the Mill Creek City Council to order, and Spencer will be leading us in the flag salute. Please. Thank you.
Please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, Spencer.
Thanks, Spencer.
Thanks.
Wait, what troop are you with?
Troop 39.
And you're working on your Eagle Scout badge?
Communications badge.
Good deal. Well, welcome.
Thanks.
Okay, first up is audience communication. Anybody want to talk
roll
to
call.
The... What? Roll call. That's right. I just looked and saw everybody here.
Mayor Pruitt.
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Holtzclaw. Councilmember Bond.
Here.
Councilmember Cavallari.
Here.
Councilmember Steckler.
Here.
Councilmember Todd.
Way down here.
And Councilmember Vignell.
Okay, both Councilmember Mayor Pro Tem Holtzclaw and Councilmember Vignell have scheduling conflicts, so and they let us know ahead of time. May we have a motion to excuse?
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion and a second to excuse Mayor Pro Tem Holtzclaw and Councilmember Vignell. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Abstentions? Passes unanimously. They get an extra month of voucher duty. Okay, now we're up to audience communication. Anybody want to talk to the council tonight? Going once, twice? Okay, moving along. We're down to new business, and this will be Seattle Hill Road Preservation Project. And can I say thank you for all the information that was included in the packet? It was readable and understandable, and I like being prepared. So thank you very much. Michael?
Thank you, Mayor. We appreciate the feedback. Gina Hortolosa is going to present. Director Hortolosa is to be given a large credit for the quality of the information for tonight. Project relating to Saddle Hill Road Pavement Preservation Project. It's a contract that we want to discuss if council authorizes the execution of which it's for $1,212,917.28.
Good evening, Council. Thank you, Michael. So thank you for the feedback. And tonight I will be co-presenting with Matthew Feely, who also deserves credit for the information in the packet. Few highlights prior to getting into the details of this agenda summary and this topic is going back a little bit to the beginning of the project. This project was awarded a federal grant in 2016. It was through the ICC countywide competition. So there's $720,000 federal dollars in the construction phase of the project. Because we have federal funds in the construction phase, the entire process and phase is federalized. That means that not only is the work that this contractor doing federalized, but a consultant that does construction management and anything related to the construction phase has to follow a federal process. So in 2016, again, the city was awarded the grant, and the programmed time for construction was June of 2019. However, as we started design, we realized that we needed some temporary construction easements and requested and were granted an extension to obligate to December of 2019. So that was through PSRC. And the project was subsequently coordinated with local programs to advertise. So again, because it has federal dollars, WSDOT Local Programs is involved in every step of the way. And what that means is that for us to be here tonight recommending that council award the contract, we had to get prior green light from local programs, which of course we did. Any kind of contract changes, i.e. change orders, will need to go through local programs before they come to council. So that is part of the federalized process. In addition, to the coordination with local programs, we also have done coordination with utility companies. So we have Alderwood Water District, and we have Puget Sound Energy, both of which have valves, or what's called iron, in the pavement cross-section. There's also Frontier, or Verizon, who has utilities there, and Comcast. Snohomish PUD also has utilities. Again, the ones that are physically within our work zone are Alderwood Water District and Puget Sound Energy. Coordination for with both of these for long-term and short-term has occurred. Long-term, what I refer to is our code, Chapter 12, which specifically addresses pavement disturbances. And that is that for collectors and arterials, there is more or less, although these words are not used, a moratorium of 5 years before the city allows any kind of payment cuts on brand new pavement. This moratorium, and I'm using that word fairly loosely, it's referred in the code as disturbance, also is applicable to developers. And we do have a development project along this project footprint, and that is the Three Oaks project. So we have coordinated with the Three Oaks developer, and they are very aware of our moratorium, and so that coordination has happened as well. I will, again, Matt Feely will get into the details, but I'll be happy to say that this project was advertised in late December, and the city received a whopping 11 bids. So this is the highest in 25 years of engineering experience. This is the most I've ever seen in a project. And so I feel really good on behalf of the city of Mill Creek that that happened. Renee Larson with Washington Local Programs was here for the bid opening, and she was also surprised. She participates on bid openings across the Puget Sound on a very regular basis, and she was surprised at the amount of bids that the city received. So just wanted to share that because I feel good about it. I hope you feel good about it as well.
Do you have any idea why?
That's what I was going to ask.
Part of the reason is because we advertise at a prime time when developer or contractors are looking for work. So we advertise this project in late December. It's a good sized project, and I quite frankly, I mean, that's a sign that contractors want to do business with the city of Mill Creek. We got, if you look at one of the attachments is the bid tabs, we got all types of contractors, from large contractors that do work for WashDOT to smaller contractors that have done work in Snohomish County. So it was quite the spread, and I'm also happy to say that the spread was as far as the size of the contractors, but they were very close to the engineer's estimate and very close among each other, which also raises a level of confidence as to the quality of the plans and specs that were advertised. So,
thank you.
Madam Mayor, I was going to speculate partly with I-976 and the state putting a pause on a bunch of projects that kind of put a pause on some of the things these guys are, you know, the Granite Constructions of the world are looking for big jobs, and if they had their eyes on some state things that got a pause button on them, that may have caused more people to come forward. But Gina's right, this is fantastic. The spread, you know, the dollar spread is not that wide too. It says they're all, your engineer's estimate was good and everybody was anxious to get this business. Nobody just throwing in a big number for a what if. They all want the business. I think it's because this other stuff was pending out there. Thanks.
Again, Matthew Feely will get into the details as to who was the apparent lowest bidder at the time of bid opening and who was the actual lowest responsible bidder. I will say that based on tonight's motion, the recommended award is to Cayman's Construction, and we did go through a pretty robust not only reference checks, we also had supplemental bidder responsibility criteria forms that are part of our boilerplate documents now for the City of Mill Creek. And what that means is that in addition to just regular references, they have to provide, contractors need to provide information on who their superintendent is for this project and references of projects that that particular superintendent has led. And we also require them to provide references of similar projects in nature and in size. So that is part of just our regular practice of doing business here at the City of Mill Creek for construction projects. In addition to that, because there's federal dollars, we have to go through an additional check confirming that the contractor is not debarred from federal projects, which Cayman's is not. Obviously, that's why we're here tonight. There's a particular system called SAM, System for Award Management, that the feds use. And we have to confirm that our contractors are not in that list. Definitely when they are federal dollars, they cannot be on that list. That's a debar list. And in addition to that, again, there's a set of standard procedures that we follow, like with LNI and making sure that they have a bond and insurance and different just quality control checks to confirm that the contractor that we're doing business with has capabilities and competence in doing this contractual work for the city. The last thing I'll say before I give the mic to Matthew Feely is on the topic of communications. So it's a large project, and we have roughly 15,000 vehicles per day that use Seattle Hill Road. So just as a frame of reference, you know, 35th, which was a full closure, had a similar ADT, average daily traffic. So that's the kind of traffic volume that we're dealing with here. Unlike 35th, it's not a full roadway closure. But based on the work that we have to do and the fact that we have median islands, we will need to reduce traffic to one lane in each direction at a certain time. When those periods of reducing traffic to one lane in each direction occur, traffic will be messy and it will back up. And so one of the things that we'll need to do once we have the contract awarded and we have our pre-construction meeting and we have a notice to proceed date is inform the community about that and provide as much notice for those particular timeframes as we can. We also have what's called variable message boards on either end of the project, so on the east end and on the bottom of the hill here by SR 527, so that people know when the traffic will be reduced to one lane. So we have certain measures for traffic control, but those will be fine-tuned once we have our pre-construction meeting with the contractor.
Gina, we've actually done a project up there before where it was from Village Green Drive to 35th. I know because I was mayor and cut the ribbon at the time, and communications was critical. People will be painting their houses this summer. They get upset when they paint and then dust from the, because they didn't know.
Right.
And I can say that I don't believe we had a single complaint. We had lots of compliments. We had somebody, but they were also digging and putting in tanks or something, so there would be big gaps in the road. And they had somebody assigned 24/7. If you had a problem, you could call. Anyway, you just might look and see what they did, because it worked out really well.
Well, thank you for the comment on that. We'll look into it.
Okay.
Two additional comments on communications will be that regarding to noise and just closing the loop, I know it's back going back to 2018, but Councilmember Steckler did request information at that time when Council was awarding the design contract to WH Pacific for design, information on noise generation with this pavement. So you see the memo attached as attachment D, so all factors being equal, meaning ADT, roadway conditions, the pavement, the new pavement should actually reduce the overall noise volume.
You know, I saw that and I wanted to thank you so much for the citizens along that road. Seattle Hill Road years ago did not go all the way through, and it was a roadway to get into the parks and other areas, and then we punched through. It became a thoroughfare, mm-hmm. and a lot of people who live along that road, it made it very difficult for their living environment. The fact that you listened to that and went out and found a replacement, I hope the media who's listening to this recording make sure that the citizens out there recognize the extra effort that our public works went to find that smoother surface and at least find some ways to help our citizens and reduce the noise. Thank you.
You're most
good
welcome.
Job. And thank you for listening on behalf of the citizens.
You're welcome. And the last item as far as communications relates to Title VI, and this is something that has been recently brought to our attention, and I know Michael Caravino, myself, and others are working on bringing the city forward on Title VI. Certainly this project, having federal dollars, we want to make sure that we put every effort on this. We are aware, interesting enough, as we've done outreach and collaborated with residents that live out there, that some of them do not speak English. And so in this particular project, it's specifically important, not only because there's federal dollars, but we want to make sure that all the people that live along the corridor that will be impacted are aware of the project. And again, it's not only people in Mill Creek, but also we are doing coordination with Snohomish County, Bothell, WashDOT, et cetera. So again, this project will provide additional opportunity for us to advance with respect to Title VI. And at this point, I will have Matthew Feigley get into the details of the contract, the apparent lowest bid, and who turned out to be the actual responsible lowest bidder, and go from there. Matthew.
Mayor, through the chair, while Matthew's coming up to the podium, with regard to Title VI, I really want to compliment a team effort. Last year, in late summer, we learned that we had a lot of work to do, and knowing that we had the Seattle Hill Road project coming, there was a real risk that this thing was going to blow up on us if we didn't have our ducks in a row. A tremendous amount of hustle went on in the background in order to ensure we're in compliance with Title VI, that we're going to be able to demonstrate that in furtherance of the objectives during this project, and it's going to give us a chance to be more conversant in it going forward, and to maintain a compliance checklist that would have us on an annual basis amongst a list of others saying, are we in compliance with Title VI? What else needs to be done? So this is a celebration of both substance as well as process.
Do you want to explain what Title VI is?
Title VI is a federal law mandating, frankly, what for many of us are common sense objectives with regard to ensuring, for example, inclusion with regard to language barriers for traffic safety, and ensuring that with regard to participation in bids and opportunities to bid on work, we have advertised and marketed it in a way that's inclusive to our entire community.
Thank you.
Good evening, Council. Matthew Feigley, Supervising Engineer. I'll also say that I'm an Eagle Scout, so good luck on your journey. I see your second class, so a few more ranks to go. Yeah, as Gina said, I'm going to present some of the more details of the project. So getting into it, kind of go over a brief project overview, look at the funding, details of the construction contract, and then the next steps moving forward. So the overlay of Seattle Hill Road is going to take place between Village Green Drive and 35th Avenue Southeast. It is a full-width overlay. The entire road will be overlaid between those two points. And kind of talking about traffic control, like Gina mentioned earlier, the two ends of the project will have the variable message signs deployed before the contractor starts. The actual paving work, there's two main parts to the work that's going to happen. We're going to have concrete and traffic signal work occur first, and then later in June after school lets out, that's when the most traffic impacts will be in place. That'll be the full-width grinding overlay. So. And like Gina said, we do have traffic control plans that have been developed, and it's going to be one of those things we're going to deploy the traffic control per the plan and be out there in the field and monitor and adjust as necessary, which is typical with most public works projects to get that fine-tuning done right at the start of it.
So. And emergency vehicles will always be able to get through.
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Yes, and we've already started our coordination with the police department and preliminary talks when the traffic control plans were developed. So. So like I stated, this is going to be a 2-inch grind and overlay, so they're going to take off at least 2 inches of pavement, and it'll be overlaid with brand new hot mix asphalt. We're also going to be out there replacing the damaged median curbs. There's several sections where the curbs have been damaged, especially on some of the median noses themselves where cars have hit them, so those will be replaced and repaired. Like usual, we're going to be updating ADA curb ramps, and then along with that, at the two signalized intersections, we are going to install accessible pedestrian signals, referred to as APS, at both those intersections. And what APS is, it's the newer units that have the locator tone that assist people that are blind or vision impaired to locate it, and so brand new buttons and everything like that. So those units will be on their own separate poles, so we'll have a few more poles out there. The conduit will have to be run, and some conductors installed, and that hooked up to the existing signal system. So project funding. So like Gina mentioned, this project is federalized. We have a federal grant of $720,000. Of local funds, we have $1,135,000. bringing our total construction budget to $1,855,000. So construction contract, we received 11 bids from contractors, from all, from smaller contractors all the way to the large ones, Granite, Cadman, that do a lot of WashDOT projects. So when we opened bids, you can kind of see that the summary of what we have. Our engineer's estimate was $1,272,600. These were the three lowest bidders, R.W. Scott being the first apparent low bidder, and then working our way up to SVR Construction. So during this time, we received the bids, we opened them. Our apparent low bidder was R.W. Scott Construction. So what we do in Public Works, we take those bids back. We input all the numbers into our spreadsheet, essentially checking the math. It's very simple math. It's multiplication and addition. So going through doing some of those math checks, we found some errors with R.W. Scott. They used the wrong quantities for their calculations. We made them aware of that error. They reviewed what they had submitted, and they contacted myself and requested that they be relieved of their bidding responsibility for this project due to a more significant error that was not readily apparent to us. In talking with their estimator, they omitted $30,000 of a mobilization cost, which is a lump sum. There's no fixed quantity to it. We would have no way of knowing that they had missed it. Only they know. So what we thought was a simple math error on their part and could easily be rectified, turns out there was a larger error. They requested to be relieved. So we followed the WashDOT standard specifications section 1-03.4, requested that they send us a notarized affidavit asking to be relieved of the project so that we could be free to award the construction contract to the next lowest bidder. So R.W. Scott's construction, their bid was withdrawn. We had a WashDOT review this too, so that was okay. Everything was done per the specs. So then our next lowest bidder becomes Kamen's Construction, which they came in at $1,212,917.28. And I think if I go back, the two lowest bidders were awful close to each other. So. So kind of an overview of the construction budget now. So our contractor, Kamen's Construction, we have their amount of $1,212,917.28. That's for their construction contract. And then with this project, since this is a federalized project, there is a significantly more paperwork and documentation that has to be completed because we will be audited by WashDOT and FHWA to make sure everything was done fully compliant. So with that, we have construction management of $240,000, and then with this project, we have a contingency of $131,000, bringing the total construction budget to $1,583,917.28. So our next steps with this project, and this will be the next presentation, the first item here, will be the interlocal agreement with Alderwood Water and Wastewater District. That's in relation to the city being reimbursed for the work that our contractor will perform to adjust the manhole covers and valve box covers that are out in the road. It's accounted for in our project budget. Our contractor will do that work, and then we'll get reimbursed for it because it is actually it's Alderwood's structures that are being adjusted, and it belongs to them. So, so that'll be the next presentation. After that, we're in the process. We put out an RFQ for our construction management consultant. So we should be receiving those packages. We will review them, and we'll be selecting that consultant to perform that work for us. So that will be the next award for this project. And then coming closer to the construction portion of it, we're going to have the communication and coordination with the stakeholders. So all the residents and neighborhoods along Saddle Hill Road, as well as other agencies, police and fire, will all start that communication process and get that coordinated with them, making everybody aware of when the construction is going to happen. This will happen after we have our pre-construction meeting with the contractor, have a better idea of the dates and times and how things are going to be working. Once we nail down some of the specifics, that we can reach out and provide that information to our stakeholders.
Hey, Matt, just a quick question. Mm-hmm. So the five, and maybe Gina can help with this too, so the five-year moratorium that gets put in place along this roadway, how does that impact the contractor that has existing work pending with the city? I mean, do we simply tell him he can't touch it for another 5 years, or what's the process there?
So for utility companies that have fiber or iron pipes, et cetera, we have coordinated with them for long term. So that long term coordination has already happened with the utility companies. The short-term coordination is that top bullet that Matt is referring to. It's the ILA, and the same thing will need to happen with Puget Sound Energy because the iron on the roadway will need to be raised. The other contractor that we're aware of at this point is for the developer, the private developer, and they are fully aware of this project. Now, within the next 5 years, they may be new development along the corridor that we don't know about, may or may not. You know, we don't really know what's going to happen within the next 5 years. The option for them to not cut through the pavement is to bore. And so it's an additional expense to the contractor. But it's either they bore or they cut through our fresh pavement. Those are the two options.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Councilmember Todd?
I'm just going to fill in some more. So this came up when Puget Sound Energy dug into Village Green Drive a few years ago. Remember, it just got overlaid, and they came in and did an upgrade. And so Scott Smith and the Public Works Department at that time said, let's put this in our code so that we force our utility partners to at least think ahead to upgrade. And so our hope here is that Puget Sound Energy is going to say, yeah, we're fine with our pipe sizes. We're not going to dig up like they did on 164th here, where they kind of come in right afterwards and change stuff. And so we're trying to get them to do their planning to not come in and do that kind of stuff. If there's an emergency repair, they can dig in, but we're trying to prevent them from doing the whole length like they did on Village Green Drive, which was kind of a shame.
Yeah, you're right. I think it's brilliant, the coordination that's taking place. I really do. Awesome job. Good job.
So like I stated earlier, we're looking at construction, issuing the contractor notice to proceed as early as April 2020. So our specifications are written that they could start the concrete and traffic signal work. That happens off to the side of the road. Doesn't require them to take the entire full width of it to perform that work. And in our specs, we have them starting in mid-June. I believe it's the Monday after Everett School District lets out. So the traffic through on the corridor should be less. So that's when the contractor can start the grinding and overlaying portion. And kind of talking with some of my colleagues and John Wheezy, our consultant that we have on board in our office, the contractor will be able to get in there and probably get the grind and overlay done in about 2.5 weeks max. They'll be running 8-hour days with, you know, machinery out there, so to get that done relatively quickly. So, then we're looking at a September 2020 completion. So after the road's ground and overlay, they'll be out there doing the utility, making sure the iron is all level with the new pavement and all the striping and pavement markings. So we're looking at having the entire project completed September 2020 before it starts raining again. So,
Mike?
Yeah. So, question. When Snohomish County was doing their Seattle Hill Road project in 35th, there, I remember there was some discussion about channelization or signals or something or other. Does this project, you mentioned signalization as part of this, are we doing something there at our piece, the west leg of that intersection? Is there something we're doing that makes it different?
No. So that signal system is going to remain as it is. It has the APS units installed. That's fully up to... That's as upgraded as it can be right now. So, yeah, we're not going to touch that.
So in terms of the user interface, this is going to be a nice new pavement, ADA ramps, stuff like that, but there's really going to be the same medians and the same lane, turn lanes and stuff like that.
Yes, correct.
Thank you.
We'll have a lot smoother road. Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay, so the proposed motion tonight is to authorize the city manager to execute the construction contract with Cayman's Construction in a not-to-exceed amount of $1,212,917.28.
I'd be happy to make that motion.
I'll second it.
I have a motion and a second. Any further questions or discussion?
Good job, staff.
Well done.
Good bids. Well done.
Well
Thank
done.
You.
Okay, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Abstentions? Passes unanimously. And now we're up to part two of this, the interlocal agreement between Alderwood Water and Wastewater District and the City of Mill Creek. Michael?
Thank you, Mayor. Once again, we'll have Director Hortolosa and Matthew Feely presenting. Gina?
Thank you, Michael. So this particular agenda summary only has one attachment, and it's the ILA with Alderwood Water and Wastewater District. The purpose of this ILA is actually to provide a better public experience to the public in the sense that our contractor will be driving the schedule. The city will be the lead in adjusting water valves and iron on behalf of Alderwood Water District. The city will pay the contractor, and then we will invoice Alderwood Water District for the construction costs that we pay Cayman's Construction, and also there's a reimbursement for construction management. So there's an inspection aspect to this ILA. I will say a correction under the city manager recommendation. There's a dollar amount of $14,605. That's the dollar amount that we got in our bid item from Cayman's Construction. In reality, that is not what we're going to get reimbursed, because we're also going to get reimbursed for construction management. So the proposed motion has 100% of costs associated with utility adjustment work related to water valves and sewers, and that is what the ILA identifies. There is an exhibit in the ILA that was prepared before bids were opened. It's Exhibit A and Exhibit B, two exhibits that show an estimated amount, and those were estimated amounts as of December prior to having, again, more fine-tuned estimated amounts from bid opening. So that's where that $34,701.75, those were just estimates prior to the bid opening. And at this point, I would like to open up for any questions.
I have a general question.
Yes.
For this whole project, we're not going to do this project and find out in 5 years we've got stormwater pipe problems.
Correct. So we have checked the surface. Thank you for the question. Surface water utilities, and they were all grade A. And we checked the small and the large pipes. All pipes.
That was a great answer. That was a great
about
answer.
All the other utility
wow.
people, but yeah, we're the prime.
Councilmember Cavallari.
Thanks, Mayor. Just real quick, I want to pass a compliment to all involved that this is a fantastic body of work here. The due diligence that was and the detail that was paid attention to is really a benefit I don't think the taxpayer usually sees up from the point of fact-checking the bidding that went on to make sure that they were appropriate, their numbers, and excluding some folks that might have caused problems or costs later, all the way through the moratorium piece to make sure that everybody's on the same page to keep the process flowing. I think this is an incredible body of work. This product is a fantastic result of some great teamwork and some hard, good stuff here. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, so we have a motion, and Mike.
Just fine. So, Madam Mayor, I'd be happy to make the motion that we authorize the city manager to execute an interlocal agreement with Alderwood Water and Wastewater District for utility adjustment work related to water valves and sewer manhole covers in an amount not to exceed $34,701.75.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any additional discussion or questions?
I just had a quick question that you mentioned that the 34,000, we're going to get more than that, so.
It'd be less than that. The 14.
Oh, I thought you said no more than that when you just did the motion. I thought you said no more than 34,000.
That's what the motion is in the packet. I think that's the right, is that the right motion?
The motion is on the top of the agenda summary, so it's for 100% of costs associated with utility adjustment work related to water valves and sewer manhole covers.
That's been made in
second. The amazing part here is that I caught that. That's what's
yeah.
crazy. That's,
I was looking down the recommendation.
Yeah.
My fault.
My goodness.
Would you like to take back your motion?
I can't take it back once it's been seconded. We should vote it down.
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll vote this one down, and we have the option to vote this one down and make the correct motion. So all those in favor signify by saying aye. Opposed? Nay.
Nay.
Abstentions? Okay, motion fails. Would you like to try again?
I don't know. Two tries? motion is to authorize the city manager to execute an interlocal agreement with Alderton Water and Wastewater District in order for the city to be reimbursed by the district for 100% of the costs associated with the utility adjustment work related to water valves and sewer manhole covers.
I would second that.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Michael, do you have anything to add?
No, I don't.
Any further questions?
I want to go for a third time. Thank you, John, for finding that.
Okay, so we have a motion and a second. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Abstentions? Passes unanimously. Now we're on to item D, Police Department update to Council regarding data metrics for two police cruiser vehicles. They have new information that is on the Diaz for you to look at. In the future, we'll try to get you stuff earlier, and some of this stuff isn't, the font's too small to read, so don't know what that's for.
Mayor, we'll work on, let me just first explain the animus for this. This conversation came up during our budget discussions, where there was a strong desire by council to reformulate our policy for vehicle replacement so that rather than being driven by an actuarial schedule out of accounting books, it would be driven by actual maintenance experience for the vehicles. With regard to our entire fleet, we're in the process of reformulating policy. This was intended to be a check-in with council to show you what we've done to develop our new policy and ensure that we're on the same place that we are with council. The delay in getting the maintenance records to you, that responsibility falls on me. And my intention is not to necessarily act in allowing a purchase to take place after tonight's meeting, but to make sure that as we work to develop a new written policy, we would come back at a later date and share that with council. Having said that, there is an opportunity, if council agrees that we're on the right track, to purchase two additional police cruisers as part of a joint purchasing pool with the state of Washington before March 31st. So this is intended to be a good faith check-in with council to make sure that we're all in the same place. Chief?
Thank you, Michael. Thank you, council. This, as Michael said, really this is an information sharing opportunity. I think it's important to maybe give a picture of the status of our fleet and what not only the two vehicles that we currently have ordered, that we ordered last year that we had not yet received, we'll talk about that in a moment, and then what we would do with the two vehicles that we're requesting to purchase this year that would arrive near the end of 2020. So we'll review again our fleet, review the process for ordering police vehicles on the state bid in Washington State, review our fleet funding schedule, discuss purchase decision criteria, discuss replacement and maintenance projections and the value that has in making purchasing decisions, and then, like I just mentioned, presenting what our fleet will look like when the two new cars get here and then additional cars at the end of the year. So we currently have four what we call primary patrol vehicles, so I just want to define what that is. These are the ones patrol officers are driving on patrol, the ones that they would respond in emergency fashion, potentially get into pursuits, that type of driving. We're not talking about back and forth to like you and I would do. The numbers in parentheses are the number of people currently assigned to those vehicles, so you can see that three out of the four are driven 36 out of every 48 hours, and one of them is driven 24 hours a day at full staffing. Now, we have, obviously, folks have vacation days and sick days.
To help with that, we have are actually using a 2009 Chevy Tahoe that was originally traffic vehicle that was replaced last year. Two of our sergeants are driving that, and it has emergency lights, but it's an old car. We have specialty patrol vehicles that do supplement our fleet from time to time when they're working. A K-9 officer has one, and then we have two traffic officers. The motorcycle helps us out some of the time. If Officer Bittinger is working a shift where there's only three of them working, he will park the motorcycle and jump into an SUV, so it doesn't benefit us on those days. We have two older cars that the SROs drive back and forth. So 38 is our K-9 breakdown car. It was the former K-9 car. It's got the dog seat in the back, and you can't put a bad guy back there. 39 has a engine piston problem, and that it will not accelerate quickly, and we expect it to die. We decided last year that whenever it dies, and we'll get rid of it. We were not going to spend the $8,000 to $10,000 it was going to cost to get it fixed. So that one's on borrowed time. Our two detective vehicles, we have a F-150 truck, and we're still driving a, to remind myself how old this thing is, a 2009 Dodge Avenger, which unfortunately only has about 35,000 miles on it. It doesn't get driven very often. So that's why we still have it. The chief and deputy chief vehicle, and then our old detective sergeant car we use to drive to training. It's an unmarked vehicle, and our citizen patrol is using that for their parking enforcement and park checks. So ordering vehicles, we order our vehicles through Washington Department of Enterprise Services on a state bid. Columbia Ford down in Longview has the bid, has been for quite a while. Ordering is open through the first of the year through March 31st every year. After that, you have to wait till the following year to get it on the vehicle on the state bid. And what we're ordering are police packages and the conveniences that it's going to come equipped with some things that we need, and then we take our vehicles up to FCI in North Bend to get the rest of the equipment installed. But also, these are police interceptor vehicles, and so they've got the suspension and the engines and that sort of thing to withstand the police driving. Vehicles are delivered 9 to 12 months later. As an example, we ordered a vehicle in February of last year. We haven't got it yet. We're almost in March.
Why is that?
Well, that won't happen every year, but Ford was retooling. The 2020s are a different body style. I haven't even seen one yet. But they're a little different, and they had to retool. So we're still going to be in the 9 to 12 month range, but we're going on 13 months right now. We have one car. I should just clarify. We have one car. It's up at FCI. We're still waiting for the other one.
So what's going to happen if, for instance, the factory shut down for 2 or 3 months, or with the coronavirus? Does that just, I mean, are our vehicles okay until the next vehicles arrive?
Yeah, we'll talk about that. So we're that's where the projection comes into play, because we're having to look a year down the road. It takes 2 to 3 weeks to equip them once they show up. Our vehicles cost approximately $35,000, and we put about $15,000 worth of equipment when you count push bars and lights and screens and all that kind of stuff. This does not include the mobile computer. Those are handled by IT in a separate budget, and they're on their own schedule that James manages.
Just curious, do you issue the MDTs to the officer or to the vehicle?
Vehicle, yeah. And sometimes we'll get away with, depending on when we bought the MCT, it may last long enough to go into a new vehicle. So we're not automatically buying a new computer every time we replace a car. It just depends on when it was purchased and how James figures out the life of it. He does a pretty good job of keeping them going. So our funding schedule, I'm sure you're aware of, we take our purchase price, we inflate that by 10%, and then we amortize that over either 5 or 7 years right now. So 5 years is for a patrol vehicle, 7 years would be for an admin or detective vehicle. And that's how we're the finances budgeting, they're funding our equipment replacement is based on an amortized inflated replacement costs. And that's about all I'll be able to say on that. I understand Andrew's coming to a future council meeting, so you need to get deeper in the woods than that, then she's probably your better person, unless Michael wants to chime in. But this is I should say that these this data was done in conjunction with Andrea Dowell, our finance consultant. I will point out the mileage discrepancy there between 40, and I'm focusing on 40 and 41 because the two cars that we're wanting to purchase this year will replace 40 and 41 as primary vehicles. So that'll make more sense in a moment. But there is a 20,000-mile discrepancy, and while I wasn't here when this happened, 41 spent a lot of time getting fixed, and so I had a lot of downtime. It also can depend on what, I hate to say this, but whether a sergeant drives it versus a patrol. So their sergeant's going to spend more time in the station. And one of the things that we want to do to do a better job of is how we're managing even how many people are driving it and what their assignment is. So if we have a vehicle like this that is low on miles, that probably doesn't need to be driven by the sergeant who's got office tasks to do. We want to make sure that as many patrol officers are driving those low mileage cars so we can get those mileage up. And that'll factor into our conversation here in a minute.
Chief?
Yes.
So, and I know every department struggles with, I guess the best way of saying it is like, what's the better deal? Do we keep it for a mileage capacity or do we keep it for a year capacity? Especially if we're on this constant evolution of change outs every 4 to 5 years. So I guess cost-wise, I mean, that would probably be the analysis that I would like to see, or that comparative data.
And I think I have that for you.
Okay, all right, thank you.
So let me know if I haven't answered
or
satisfied that. No, not at all. Some of this data is, not on this screen, but you'll see that we're on these two vehicles, we have an anticipated replacement date at the end of this year. So here's the criteria that I am proposing, and that is to answer Councilmember Cavalieri's partially answer his question, is primarily based on mileage. That's in conjunction with both years of service and maintenance costs. So mileage is important. First of all, it's an objective basis. There's no conversation about how many miles there is and putting a value judgment like maintenance would require. Maintenance is what's high maintenance for me may not be high maintenance to you. It's less of an objective standard. And there's also a direct correlation with miles and wear and tear on a vehicle, especially in a primary patrol capacity. So that's part of that. Since we're having to order cars 9 to 12 months ahead of time, projections are going to be important because we're ordering a car in March that won't be delivered until the end of the year, and we're doing that based on what we think the two cars that it would replace, what condition they will be in at the end of the year. So that's where we're looking at projections, and again, some of the work that Andrea and I did together, both projections for mileage and projections for maintenance costs. So mileage, we're looking at a criteria of 100,000 miles, and that one of the advantages is we start looking at how many people we have driving a car. Our goal is actually to get more than 5 years out of a car. So our belief is that if we can reduce we have cars that aren't being driven 24 hours a day, we're going to have lower maintenance costs, and those vehicles will last longer. We'll hopefully end up having years where we don't need to buy any cars, because we don't have any cars that have kind of hit that point. Years of service, as I mentioned before, 5 years for a primary patrol vehicle to come off of that status, and then 7 years for detective or administration vehicles. So the maintenance costs would factor in if they were excessive for the number of years of service. So it's going to be a bit of a case-by-case analysis. It's, we have a car that's 2 years old. It may be worth putting $5,000 or $6,000 of repair costs on a single breakdown, but we may not want to do that on a five-year car, if that makes sense. So it's hard to set a maintenance level and say, well, when you hit that, what our concern is that we have a car that's fairly young that has a major breakdown. Do we get rid of that car, or is it going to be more cost-effective, more of a responsible use of our funds to fix it, and then we have it for another 4 years, or to get rid of it because it's a lemon. So it's going to be a bit of a some subjectivity to that. So I think that's going to be an ongoing conversation. I think it's going to be an analysis that we will do every year. We'll have that conversation.
In fairness to you and the department and the city as well, because I don't think the public is aware, many agencies, if not most, the officers take their cars home, so the amount of time that they are, I would say, operational is maybe 36 to 45 hours a week, so the mileage is lower and the amount of maintenance is obviously lower. So our guys and ladies here in Mill Creek, these cars operate essentially 24 hours a day. There's really never a break here. So if the costs seem maybe a little high, I mean, it's the nature of the beast. It's the way we've chosen to, it's cheaper than having them take them home, too. Trust me on that. So otherwise, we'd have to have a second fleet just to, kind of supplant what's missing. So just wanted to point that out. Thanks.
Thank you. So I did. I didn't want to make a decision in a vacuum, so I did check with some local agencies. Everett was the other agency I wish I'd heard back from, but I didn't. I couldn't get an answer today. And there's some consistency, but I think we're in the what we're asking for is within the ballpark with what other agencies are doing and what we've even seen just anecdotally with. Well, the kinds of issues we're starting to see and the maintenance costs we start to see as we start to approach that 100,000 mile mark. I will say that I am open to looking at other criteria. You see Marysville and Edmonds both have a year or a mileage, and they say whichever comes first. I think that there's some wisdom to that, and when I talk about 5 years and 7 years, that just because we hit that mark doesn't mean we're replacing it. If it doesn't have the mileage or the maintenance cost to justify the replacement, then we keep it. So some projections. So based on I'm just looking at 40 and 41 because I hear you about small print. If I tried to do all the cars, you'd be throwing things at me. But based on the mileage so far, we're projecting that at the end of the year, car 40, who's at 101,000, almost 102,000 miles, will be at 119,000. And projecting that car 41, that's at almost 81,000, will be at about 95,000. Now, that's also without taking some real intentional steps to increase the mileage on 41. So I'm still confident that we can get that car up to 100,000 miles by the end of the year. And then also projecting maintenance costs. So you'll see the maintenance costs for vehicle 40 are almost $20,000. I will share with you, I don't know if you have a similar experience at the county, but the EcoBoost turbocharged vehicles have all sorts of issues with the coils and the turbochargers going out, and we have replaced them several times. The difference in maintenance costs between 40 and 41 is that 40s, like most of our appliances, broke down after the warranty was over, right? And so, but 41 broke down while the warranty was still in effect. So it had similar maintenance costs, but for the city, some of that was covered by warranty, and so it wasn't out of pocket for us. So that's the difference in the cost there. But I did do a projection as to based on the years of service and the average maintenance, what the projected maintenance replacement the cost would be at the replacement date at the end of this year. This is a table just showing each of the vehicles and then their maintenance costs in their first through their seventh year. So you can see we've got some cars that they're in their fourth year. None of these slides, these next few slides are going to surprise you. As years go by, maintenance costs go up. I'm sure it's the same with our personal cars, but especially with emergency vehicles. So if we put those in a line graph, you can see that we've got some dips in some years, but they tend to go back up. And then I just did a scatter table with some did a linear regression analysis, and so these are trend lines, and the steeper the line, the greater the increase has been over the years. But you can see that they're all consistent, and again, not anything that we don't already know, but as cars get older, maintenance costs go up. Okay, so I showed you our current fleet, so let me introduce you to what we're doing with the two new cars. So their numbers are 50 and 49. We're able to reduce the number of people that are driving each car. We will be assigning the old traffic car to Sergeant Phillips, who's on the SWAT team. He really needs a vehicle that he can put his gear on and be able to respond quickly. And then we'll still have the other three specialty patrol vehicles.
So is that just stored here, or does he actually take that home?
Yeah, we're going to allow him to take that home. So we have a provision to be able to do that. But it's also one of those things that if we were in a pinch, like we've done with Chris White's car when in traffic, we'd go and get it. Unfortunately, 38 and 39 will still need to be driven by the SROs. If that works for us right now, because even though they're older cars that were replaced as primary patrol vehicles last year, driving back and forth to the schools works. And so we have a marked car out in front of the schools, and we have that visual deterrent. So it's also when they're not working, so weekends and evenings, the car is available for pay details and not really patrol work, because you can't put a bad guy in 38 and 39. You can't accelerate very fast. Our detectives and police service support officers vehicles remain the same, admin, and then training and citizen patrol for 31. So the two cars that we're asking to purchase next month to be able to get here by the end of the year, this is what that would look like. We would be removing 40 and 41 as primary patrol vehicles. Our specialty patrol vehicles would stay the same. 39 would be the only remaining breakdown car. But again, we're just going to keep it till it dies, and then it'll go away. The SROs will give 40 and 41. So we're still getting mileage on these cars, even though they have reached the 100,000-mile mark. They are past 5 years. They're still getting driven. They're still available for training. They're still available for breakdown cars if we're really in a pinch. I'll explain how that's not our first choice. And they're still available for our paid details, where we just need a car with flashing lights on the side of the road while they're fixing something. Let me address what I was just saying. One of the advantages as well for the fewer people driving cars, so you may see some that have only two people assigned, and so that out of a 24-hour period that may be driven 12 hours. That also allows us to have vehicles that are here at the station when we're at shift change, for example. We already have people out at a scene, and we need additional officers to respond. Because right now, if we go back to our current fleet, we are hard-pressed to be able to respond in any sort of emergency fashion if we already have a shift of five that are on a critical scene.
Chief, in terms of data, do you have any idea of how frequently this shift change and vehicle shortage has bedeviled the department?
Yeah, I will admit it doesn't happen very often, but that's a really bad feeling when you're you're here, you're either at the scene and you need more people, or you're here and you are having difficulty being able to respond. We also, that prepares for cars that break down, that we have primary patrol vehicles that can be used because somebody else isn't driving them. It allows us to, we have to take our primary cars to EVOC, our emergency vehicle operations course training, because we would break our other cars, the high mileage cars.
Michael, Tara had concerns that we were replacing our vehicles too soon and costs and what have you. Is the information here tonight addressing her concerns?
No, it does not. Again, what was intended was to present this work, and you've reminded me of something that I have not actually consulted or even shared with Chief Eastman.
Okay, thank you.
And then we would still have the Citizen Patrol car, and with 38 would be essentially relegated to a breakdown car for the K-9 officer, but again, could still be used for a traffic detail or something like that. And that's it. I'm happy to answer any questions. Again, just like Michael said, just opportunity to share a vision and the reasons behind it.
Councilmember Bond.
Thank you, Mayor. Thanks for the presentation. I think this is a topic that we should spend some more time on. Oops.
Grace hung up on us. It's okay.
Maybe Grace didn't know if you hang up. I had just a couple thoughts. I'm going to more like throw out just as brainstorming. Essentially, what my position is, let's move forward and get these vehicles. And I don't think the current situation is acceptable, and I appreciate you bringing it to our attention and giving us a chance to move forward with getting it better. My thoughts are on the two admin vehicles. Tell me what those are.
The chief and the deputy chief vehicles?
Do they have a radio? Do they have lights? Do they have soft graphics? Or are they command vehicles equipped with things where you show up and take over the scene? Do you prop the back of the top? What is this thing?
Yeah, that's a great question. They are equipped with minimal lights, like you might find in a detective vehicle, lights and siren.
What make of vehicle is it?
So we have a 2015 police interceptor sedan. And a 2019 Ford Explorer, not a police interceptor, just a stock XLT. Okay. That's the vehicle that I drive. Both the chief and I are responsible for responding, as you can imagine, 24 hours a day, and so those vehicles help facilitate that. We are working to do a better job of having more command material in there, but there are some supplies in there. I'd like to get a command board in there, for example.
Right.
But it's not equipped with anything like, you know, sometimes you see the radios that are attached to the back of a vehicle, so you can set up kind of a command post.
So my thoughts on that, and more just food for thought tonight, it's not a, but maybe make a note, we can talk some other time. I see that there's one part of it which is just the perk of the position. Okay, it gives you a chance to take home car and your position, and a sort of a reward for that, which is nice. We could debate on that. I'm not, but if we're going to do that, then let's do it sort of what I would say, do it right, and make these vehicles appropriate emergency response vehicles, so that when you show up, or somebody else, maybe one of your sergeants says, this is a big incident, we need the big dog Tahoe that's equipped with the boards and things, you know, like fire does when it's a like big crisis, sort of a mobile command center type of a thing. You can do a lot out of a Tahoe or some similar vehicle. So if we're going to have those two vehicles, I would like to see them equipped at that level and also sort of as a breakdown. So let's just say bad luck strikes. I mean, we've had situations, we had a pursuit and like four patrol cars go bonk, 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 you know, into each other, and they're off the road. Well, that maybe could be handled at the county level, but that's going to be a big headache for us to lose even two vehicles in our current state from a collision that just could happen. We try hard to avoid those types of things, but it can happen. So these two vehicles could also be part of a worst-case scenario. You show up for work, guy comes in to do a patrol shift, takes that vehicle for the day or something, right? Just an ace up the sleeve. I'm not planning for that. That's just a worst-case scenario, but we have that. In my mind, it justifies the position of those vehicles. They're command-level crisis stuff. You barricaded the person, a prolonged incident, and you've got things in that vehicle that may not necessarily be in every patrol car. School resource officer position. I like the fact that although we can't put bad guys in, we can only do dogs or teenagers. Okay. I did school resource. I know that it's rare that you ever transport, but I do think that the school resource officer vehicle should be equipped to transport, even if it's just a public a courtesy ride. Some kid missed the bus or something, needs a ride home. And I just thought to myself, well, does the school district partner with us on this? And could that resource vehicle, school resource officer vehicle, have some decals that sort of separate it, like, you know, a little celebrate the school district, the Spartans or whatever our guys are. I don't know. The Timberwolves. I couldn't remember. I went to Spartans because I was Shoreline. So just a thought. And I know that school resource is a challenging position, and I think having a vehicle assigned to that guy is sort of or gal as a perk. Hey, you know what? If you choose to tackle the extra duties of being the resource officer, we've got a vehicle here, and it's, you set it up how you want it. Maybe you've got things specific to the resource position that you know, if you're teaching a class, you might have some supplies, whatever. I mean, you've got an office that's not necessary. I'm just brainstorming. I'm not saying we have to do it.
Because we're short, we haven't done anything fancy like that. We have talked about it. We do have the magnetic placards that at least identify it as a school resource officer.
Oh, nice.
But those can be taken off and somebody can use it for something. I appreciate what you said.
I love the courage of putting magnetic, easily removable decals on a vehicle and parking it at a high school.
Yeah, knock on wood, we haven't lost any.
That's courageous of you. I would not dare that. So anyway, just a few thoughts. I love the presentation. I think we need to get the vehicles. I do one other thing. I'm not a big fan of 100 miles and then we pull the trigger, because Deputy Bond, brand new, fresh out of the academy, got in the car with 90,000 miles, knew if I just got it to 100, I could get my new ride. And now I'm doing laps for 8 hours to get my, because I'm not stupid, right? I need a new car. 100,000 miles is the new car. So what I'd rather have, it just human nature is what it is, right? We know this. Cops are very clever and creative at overcoming obstacles. So what I think is a more of a common sense thing. If you go out, if your guy or gal says 41's acting up, and you go out and it's got 90,000 miles and it's just beat to the ground and it needs to be replaced, maybe it needs to be replaced. Maybe the other one's running like a peach, and here we are 110 and we're still cruising along nicely. So different cars have different things. I would like some flexibility. I think if we just go 10 years or 100,000, it makes it easy, but sometimes we stumble into some weird stuff sometimes that way. Not the end of the world, but I mean, I know that's what I would do. If I can just get 100,000 miles on this thing, then I'm going to get my new car. All right, I'm going to drive it into the ground. And that isn't necessarily the best thing.
Yeah,
I'm shocked to hear that.
Wow. I appreciate that.
Opening up, isn't
the risk with waiting until something breaks down is that we're going to be out of a car for a year while we're waiting for a new one, if we even miss the window. If it breaks down in April, we have to wait till the following March to even order it to get it by the following December. So, well,
yeah, I'm not saying that, like, the one that you're saying is running on three cylinders.
Right.
That shouldn't even be out there. I'm saying if this thing's run, I mean, any car could break down.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying ramp up, get the vehicles.
Okay, appreciate that.
I'm saying a policy that says 10 years or 100,000 miles. Again, the car that might have 50,000 miles and 9 years old still might be the one to get rid of, right? I just don't like 100,000 miles as a flat thing. If we have to do that because we just need a benchmark or 105 or 110, fine. I don't like it for the reasons I said.
Okay.
But I can see a scenario where you guys say this thing's got 98 and it's not safe to drive anymore. Mm. So we're not going to just grind out 2,000 more miles. Let's sell it now while it still starts and get something else.
Thank you.
Hey, Councilmember Steckler.
That was the most active I've seen you in a long time. You're really, I like that. That was great. Well, first of all, great job on the presentation. I learned a lot. You know, no background in this. This was very informative. And I know the purpose today was just to inform us of your thinking and how you think. And so I, you know, I'd like to digest it and take it. So just some initial thoughts, and that's all. It was kind of interesting, the criteria measurement of miles versus years. That was a fact you showed with some other cities. Hey, it's 10 years. We're getting rid of it. You know, I don't care how many miles it's got on it. I'm with you, and I'm 100,000 miles. I like the mileage as an indicator better than the years on the car. Although what I really got here was, this is an interesting fleet that we have. When you think of our police cars, I think of the patrol cars. You know, I forget all these other cars that we have. And for me, the criteria to make sure that our patrol cars are top-notch, not going to break down, and something I'd never want to see, I think it's important to protect that. So whatever you think is the right mileage or whatever, I support that. If it's 100,000, I know I keep my car past 100,000 miles, but I don't know if I want my police car to be past 100,000 miles. But then the criteria for moving it down to the other vehicles, you had a 7-year, I think it was 7-year, was it 7 years or 100,000?
If it was
120.
If it was a patrol vehicle.
Yeah, you moved it to 120 or 7 years.
I think that was actually what another agency had done. So we would, the 100,000 miles, basically we bump it down, and as we're replacing other cars, and we would then start like 38 and 39. We'll end up getting rid of those. And
great. So my question is, the driver here is the patrol cars, correct? Because the other cars, where I might not need that, if that car hits 120,000 miles and it's still operating, that's not a driver to replace that car if it's a citizen patrol car or maybe a detective car. So if it's a good car and it's running great, but the patrol cars are what drive the replacement. Is that correct?
That's correct.
I just want to clarify that point.
Yeah, and we do, again, we have three 2009 vehicles that are still being used.
In patrol?
Well, unfortunately, one of them is. That's car 33. Once these two cars, will move that one off the primary patrol rotation. But, and again, we're only doing that just to give the other cars a break.
That's great. Good to know. Thank you. Good presentation.
Okay. Mike, do you have anything?
Yeah, thanks. These pictures were great. Looking at the packet, I was struggling with the car numbers and everything else, but your little picture of the cars helped out quite a bit. It's educational for me to hear folks who know more about this talk about this. I'm coming from maybe a naive citizen or a cheapskate viewpoint on this. So 100,000 miles on a car to me is a low mileage car, and I go up from there. You know, when I buy a car, it's got 100,000 go from there. I think we also have heard the comment from folks. They come by City Hall North and they see 7 cars parked there and go, gosh, you guys got a lot of cars. That could be an anomaly, but it's happened. I can say I've seen that more than once where there's a lot of cars parked there. So I think there's an education element here as well, so their taxpayers feel like we're getting good value out of it. Now, something I would throw in here, my initial reaction was 100,000 miles. Well, that's driving a car highway miles, maybe average 40 miles an hour. So it's running for 2,500 hours. I think you guys probably idle these things. And so hours on the engine are a more reliable replacement value for a car engine, but the running gear is probably on the miles. And so I don't know if the new cars, I know in a big diesel or in a boat, you have an hours meter. I think the OBD2 has hours on most of these cars as something that's available.
I know at least the 16s and on do.
They have that.
Yes.
So it'd be interesting. And I don't know, again, how do our guys sit around and idle their cars a lot, or are they just driving around at 25 miles an hour?
There's a fair amount of idling, for sure. And you can imagine being on a collision scene, how long that car is just sitting there
idling. Yeah, we're doing traffic control out here in the middle of the night. That's just idling away. So maybe that's also, I just re-educated myself thinking about that. Yeah, 100,000 miles of my car, I'm turning it off when I'm not going anywhere. You guys got a lot of clock hours in those engines, and so those engines, instead of 2,500 hours at 100,000 miles, could be 2 or 3 times that. And so I appreciate that's a value out there too. I'm with Councilmember Bond and others, too. Hearing more about this and understanding our philosophy and our strategy makes some sense. What Councilmember Bond was talking about is making sure if we need to have cars backing up because we have a small fleet overall, we're backing up because of a crisis or because of a breakdown. I hadn't thought about that before. Maybe making sure they're all equipped, as much as I hate to spend the money, all equipped for that emergency so we can grab another car and go if we have to. It's not what we want to do. We don't want to take the chief's car and put it out there at a scene. But if that's required, it's useful. So I'm open to those kinds of things. I'm also looking at overall, you're talking about today we got 16 vehicles and we're talking about going to 20 vehicles. So my math mind says that's 25% increase. Boy, if we keep doing this, that's going to be expensive. We've got a limit to what we've got. But maybe more money in cars is the better way to make sure we're utilizing all the expensive hours of officers because their time isn't cheap. So I don't have a good gut feel for that, but that's also something we should factor in here. If we're not being efficient with the use of our guys and gals' times, maybe more equipment makes sense. It's an interesting problem. Thanks.
I appreciate that. I want to point out that this isn't unlimited supply that we're talking about. I would expect that after the 2021, when we get a car, we buy a car, we get rid of a car. So at some point we're going to hit, and I think that last slide I showed you is getting pretty close to a manageable fleet that doesn't beat our cars up, gives the officers the safest cars to drive when they're working patrol, but gives us the support vehicles when we need it. And so, but again, there is a limit. And so I'm not asking to buy two cars every year and keep them all.
No, yeah, but I think you're saying strategically you think 20 is a better size fleet for these reasons than the fleet of 16 we've got right now.
Right. I think that last slide, the 2021 allocation, I think we'll have to play that out because we're just speculating on how many people are going to be assigned. It's also depending on staffing levels, they could be driven more with more people and less with fewer.
Yeah.
I appreciate the feedback.
Thank you. Great presentation. Thanks.
Councilmember Cavallari.
Thanks, Mayor. Real quick, I understand what a juggling act it is, especially, believe it or not, it's probably a little more difficult with a smaller agency, simply because there's just not enough cars to go around, theoretically, when you think about it. So the 100,000-mile benchmark that you're using, I get it. I understand it because you have to – I know the maintenance costs go up on average at vehicles that utilize that much mileage. It just costs that much more to fix them. So replacing them or having some sort of philosophy in place that this is what we do at this is appropriate. So at this mileage is appropriate. So I kind of understand it. Then you use kind of the multiplier of the purchasing power between January and March as the only opportune moment to get these vehicles. And then you incorporate that into the equation and you really have, so I understand why we're doing the 100,000 and understanding why there has to be a set time and to revolve these vehicles around. So I get that and I support it. Second is I also, until Mark asked the question, did not know that the admin vehicles weren't fully equipped, and it's kind of a surprise to me, but I would support retrofitting those to be fully operational.
And we may have to change our purchasing decisions. When we purchased the Ford Explorer, it literally is a mom and pop right off the, you would not want to drive that over freeway speeds. None of them have cages. You couldn't put a prisoner in there. There's no place to store a rifle. There are some challenges, and it's not saying that we can't spend the money to do all of that, probably except for the cages. But the good news is if the stuff's hitting the fan at that point, I'm driving my own car and I'm on my way. They won't need to.
Then I guess as a philosophical conversation to have is that in the future when we're purchasing these, that we understand that the admin vehicles, you know, they need to be operational, you know, at any moment too. So
I
would support it, just like I think Mark was saying, and so did Councilmember Todd. So I think you have our support here, and Steckler.
Noted. Thank you.
And I'd just like to add, I'd like to see the financial numbers. What this is going to cost, it's all great to say that we like this stuff. I do too. But the reality is what's it going to cost? And how are you going to pay for it? So we owe the taxpayers that information in addition to the fact that we need the cars.
And so, we can get some more precise costs. The two vehicles that we're talking about purchasing were added in the biennial, the mid-biennium budget.
So the amortization schedule you showed us here is in the budget.
Yeah. The funds to purchase the vehicle.
The funds are in there.
The Councilman Stuckler? I'm sorry.
55,000, sorry.
No, I interrupted you. I apologize. Finish your answer.
No, just that the council approved a budget amendment to replace two vehicles this year at 55,000 each.
A couple of thoughts. First of all, Mayor Pruitt's comment is well taken. There is data that I now recall that our interim finance director, Tara Dunford, provided. I will work with you tomorrow. We have a March 31st deadline, and that was one of the reasons why I wanted to address this evening, is we can go back, do our homework. And what's of paramount importance to us is that, yes, it was appropriated, and we also made the representation, given that we are looking to modify this policy, that we would report back to you before I authorize the spending. So this is us fulfilling our promise, even though the appropriation is there. And it's going to help us develop a policy going forward, particularly capturing these suggestions regarding future purchases, that even if they're solely for administrative or chief deputy chief use, that they would be equipped to be fully operational if they need to be deployed for patrol vehicles, if, God forbid, we have an accident that wipes out a couple of our usual cruisers. So,
well, we did go through that for a while.
Well, it happens.
There are horror stories about officer-involved shootings where cars end up being in evidence for a long time.
Or how about the ones when on 132nd, people just be drunk and speeding and plow into one of our cars. That happened 2 or 3 times. So, no, I mean, you've got to stay on top of it. And then when we meet this week, let's get this scheduled so we don't miss the deadline on the new cars.
Absolutely.
So
thank
we will
you, Mayor.
Move forward with that. Councilmember Bond.
So I just want to be clear, support you moving forward, like the presentation. I was brainstorming some ideas that I thought we could bring to a study session later. Mm-hmm. It may be that it's most efficient to just have a radio in a fuel-efficient sedan-type vehicle that is your chief, so you're running from the radio, and then when you show up in that vehicle, the Tahoe, with all the bells and whistles, is already there for you. Maybe Bobby Phillips went and grabbed it or something. I mean, there's a way we can do this. I'm not saying this is the way. I was just throwing out some ideas. So what I really would like to say is maybe when we have a time, and I don't see it in the near future because our schedule is pretty busy, but it'd be a good discussion. What are our fleet needs? What are we doing? What's animal control doing? Are we providing? Animal control is a challenging job. And some cities do a better job of equipping their animal control officer with the right vehicle and tools, and some cities don't. And so, just as an example, I mean, I'd like to talk about the vehicles and what we're doing.
Happy to do that.
We will get that scheduled.
If everybody wants to. I just...
Sounds fascinating. No.
This whole thing just sparked an interesting conversation.
Okay,
thank you.
Councilmember Todd?
Yeah, so I think same thing you're saying. I think this is worthy of more discussion and appreciation. It sounds like there's a deadline on two patrol vehicles, what we know, what configuration they need to be, but this deadline is by the end of the month. If we want to get in on this cycle,
yes,
we have to do it. We're all going, 9 months, this is just crazy. It's hard to believe, but that's the reality. So we may be faced with making a decision to go ahead with this, but I don't think that's the end of this. I think the brainstorming session on how we do this whole thing, it'd be helpful for us, it'd be helpful for the citizens to understand where the money's going and make sure we make the best financial decision. I saw something, I'll get another question here. I saw Mark's gonna make a great comment. You can brew on that for a second. Something in here about a hybrid vehicle. A couple of years ago, the state legislature made this great decision that all vehicles had to be eco something or other. It was going to include everything. Then they changed the rules so it wasn't in cop cars sort of thing. But are we facing some chronological or point in time in the future when we're mandated to do something with respect to hybrids or?
Not yet. My understanding was that was for state vehicles. And I think there was actually an exemption for emergency vehicles because you can imagine they
Yeah. When it first came out, it was like all vehicles 2018 had to be whatever. It's like, no, we're not going to throw away the old dump truck. And we're not.
I will share with you quickly that while we did order these two new vehicles that are coming, our hybrids, we're evaluating. We're working with Linwood, who did some field tests, and to see what the whether we're going to get the bang for our buck, because those cars can also have some expensive fixes as well. So what we may save in costs, we may suffer in maintenance costs. So this will be this year will be a good chance to evaluate and then decide how we want to go with our fleet going forward.
So the two that are
definitely not the turbos.
Yeah,
we're done with those.
You're done with those. Okay, good. So the two that are already coming on their way are the hybrids to test?
Well, we'll have those. But Linwood actually took some cars out and did some emergency vehicle testing and kind of put them side by side with some other vehicles to see how they were performing. What's going to take some time is what the maintenance costs will look like.
Community Transit, we did it side by side. Oh, we ought to have hybrid buses. And so they bought 25 hybrid buses, 40-foot buses that were hybrid, and 25 that were just exactly the same. And they interchanged them all the same routes, didn't pay attention to what was which. Got all done, and it cost $200,000 more for a hybrid bus than a regular bus. Got all done. Hybrid buses cost us more in terms of maintenance and hassle factor over the years, way more than the fuel. So you have to really want to do it to be green. It wasn't a cost savings thing at all. It was a lesson learned kind of deal. This is a different kind of vehicle, but it's what sounds great sometimes doesn't work out in terms of dollars and cents. Thanks.
Did you say that the two vehicles that we're buying now are, or we're going to buy it before the end of March, are they hybrid vehicles?
So I haven't decided yet. And the ones that are sitting up in North Bend getting equipped right now are hybrids.
And those are full patrol cars?
They are.
Okay.
And so what we're doing is we're trying to collect some data so we can make the best decision on the cars that we're asking to order next month.
And when are those cars going to be here?
They would, if
two
we're
up
lucky,
in North Bend.
We're 2 or 3 weeks away.
Nice. So you're not really going to get a chance to test them.
No, we're relying on other agencies that have done some of that. We won't. It's okay. Cheaper for us to let them spend the time and the money and the racetrack fees.
And these two are hybrids because you just wanted to try it?
That was the decision that was made last year, and so it probably seemed like a good idea at the time. So time will tell.
Okay. Anybody else? Thank you very much.
Thank
good
you.
Presentation.
Appreciate it.
Okay, now we're up to item E, Snohomish County Arts Commission small grant opportunity.
Thank you, Mayor. While Meredith Cook approaches the podium, this, in essence, is a grant that will enable us to defray some of the costs related to the frame and structure that will support our historic preservation panels. We can apply. One of our council members asked a question, and we researched it. This specific grant, has not been applied for before, and we're not precluded from applying for it here. As I understand it, our DPW is currently not equipped to actually do the welding and construct the frame. And so what we would be doing is pursuing this grant opportunity with council's permission to defray the costs in the amount of $2,000. And going through the grants for arts and culture, this would most likely fall under the cultural enrichment performance arts grants to the extent we would have these panels erected in the community. It would contribute towards the culture and the heritage and the background that has made the city of Mill Creek what it is today. Meredith?
Thank you. And I would just add that we actually did apply to this grant last year, but for something completely separate. The A&B board did apply for a small amount of dollars for the utility box wrapping project, which was completed. So that was discovered earlier today as well. Maybe you were thinking of that. This is for your blessing or green light to pursue the Snohomish County Arts Commission small grant in the amount of up to $2,000. And again, I cannot believe we're still talking about the panels, but they are completed, they are gorgeous, and they're sitting in an office ready to be installed. So just to give you a little flashback of what's been going on with these, best to my knowledge, 2018, I received funding from the Heritage Grant Program, which I will highlight is different from what we're pursuing at this point. The Heritage Grant Program, we were awarded $12,500, and then all of that funding was dedicated to research and design. In 2019, the city was awarded $7,806 from the same Heritage Grant Program, and all of that funding, or majority of that funding, was given to our contracted graphic designer for the purchase of these five high-pressure laminate panels, which he then embedded all of our finalized copy and graphics onto. So these were completed in December 2019, just 2 months ago. So we're now at the point where they're sitting ready for us. So the A and B board, as you guys know, are really the ones driving this project, and we need to install these five panels into the heart of town center on that bridge there. And we are pursuing $2,000 to just cushion the cost of installation for labor materials. We realize this will not cover all the installation, but we like we promised in the CIP document, we needed to pursue grant opportunities before we dove into our municipal arts fund. So I'm coming to you guys just for your blessing to apply for this grant, which is actually due in several days. So I'll be submitting it on February 28th, which is Friday.
Why 2,000?
That's all they're offering.
Max of 2,000.
Okay. Yes. If you have any questions for me or... any thoughts?
So we need a motion to authorize the city manager to apply for a grant opportunity in the amount of $2,000 to the Snohomish County Arts Commission.
Could I ask a question?
Yeah, of course.
And it just came to me, and I know we've talked in the past, but so there's more money available, but what they say is each grant, you know, has a maximum of $2,000.
Yes.
Did we ever think about, and maybe you did, could we apply for $2,000 to cover the cost of the materials for our historic project, and then pursue another grant for another $2,000 for the installation of our historic project. Same project, or is it per project or per utilization
project? My guess says no, because you'd be dedicating those funds to the city of Mill Creek, which is the same project owner.
So it's by awardee. $2,000 per awardee. Great.
Yeah.
Okay. Just curious.
That's my understanding.
I figured that was probably true, but I just thought I'd ask. That's it. Thank you.
Would you like to make a motion?
I would like to make a motion that the council approve us applying for this $2,000 grant from the Heritage Art.
Other guy. The Arts Commission.
Art Commission. Pardon
me.
$2,000 from the Arts Commission for the purpose of helping us cushion the cost of installing our new historic Mill Creek project.
Second.
Thank you.
We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion?
Just real quick, Mayor. And I know when I saw this a while ago, I gave Councilman Steckler a heads up on it, that it was probably right in our wheelhouse. And there's a lot of people that probably dismiss this because it's a very small amount of grant money, and I think the conversation we had was this is perfect for, you know, one of our boards to utilize this money for something, and so I appreciate him following up on it and referring it to you and to the department, and the citizens are now the benefactor of another $2,000 they don't have to pay. I mean, I guess technically it is all taxpayer money, but it defrays some of the costs from the city, and so the efforts are worth noting.
Okay, so we have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Abstentions? Passes unanimously. We're now up to the consent agenda. Item F, approval of checks number 61485 through 61546 and ACH wire transfers in the amount of $156,471.18. Councilmember Bond, and then I filled in for Councilmember Vignel. So, any exceptions?
No exceptions.
No exceptions. Payroll and benefit ACH payments in the amount of $317,226.43.
No exceptions.
No exceptions. And City Council meeting minutes of February 11th, 2020. Thank you for the corrections, Councilmember Todd. So do we have a motion on the consent agenda?
So move.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Abstentions? Passes unanimously. Under reports, I'd like to thank Councilmember Vignelle. She went through the vouchers this morning, although she couldn't be here tonight, and realized that there was one fence that was taken down as a result of a hit-and-run or traffic, and I guess now we're looking into whether or not the person who hit it, if we know them, was actually billed for it, because they were at fault. So, and I have a note here that I guess Jody told her that we would look into a police report on it. So no idea what's happening, but I appreciate her being thorough with that. And then tomorrow, Stephanie, and I don't know if anybody else are going to the Banner Bank economic forecast. They do it once a year. Okay, so we will be there. So I guess that's about it. Councilmember Bond?
No report.
Councilmember Steckler?
No report.
Councilmember Cavallari?
No report, Mayor.
Councilmember Todd?
Well, last time I said we were headed to the Economic Alliance, Snohomish County Legislative Day. I won't say it was a bust this year, but it was a small group. It turns out there was floor votes being taken by both the Senate and the House, and so despite that, a few people came through, Senator Hobbs came through, and we got a chance to talk to some ledge aides, but it was a smaller event this year, so we were represented, and they appreciated the fact that people drove clear down there, but it wasn't as big a deal, so you guys saved yourself of a trip by not going down there.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Community Transit, just kind of an update. There will be public outreach going on in the next few months. Up until just very recently, the plan for Community Transit was to continue to operate the express buses from Snohomish County all the way to downtown, the 400 series buses, and all the way from Snohomish County to the University of Washington campus, the 800 series buses, until light rail happened in 2024 when it gets to Linwood. Decision now, or at least we think we're going to do, is in 2021 when light rail gets to Northgate, those buses, many of those buses will truncate at Northgate, particularly the ones for UW. It makes a lot of sense to get off and get on light rail because it has two stations on the campus and gets out of the traffic jam that sucks up a lot of bus hours just waiting in traffic down there. So the 800 series buses are likely to only go as far as Northgate, and then you get on light rail. The 400 series buses are going to stay the way they are, but Sound Transit is looking at taking all the 500 series buses, which are the express buses that go downtown Seattle, and truncating those at Northgate. So the agencies, King County Metro, Sound Transit, Community Transit are all working together on what that would look like, but it would introduce many people in Snohomish County to light rail much sooner and help get to some of the congestion issues, particularly during peak operation times. When that survey is out there, they're going to obviously survey people who are commuters that are going to the campus or going downtown, but I'll make sure we find a link. And if anyone in the community is interested in knowing about that, I think the challenge is finding people who are not riding the bus because it has been so onerous to go clear downtown and then go back somewhere else. They've said, forget it, the bus doesn't work for me. I think there's new opportunities for people to say, well, if you can get out of that congestion downtown, I'll think about taking the bus and taking a different route. So I'll keep you posted on that. That's it. Thanks.
Hey, thank you. Michael, do you have anything to report?
No, Mayor.
Okay, audience communication, going once, twice. Okay, with that, we're going to recess to executive session to discuss potential litigation pursuant to RCW 4230-110-1I, and that's and we will be in executive session 15 minutes.
15 minutes with possible action afterwards.
Okay, and so that will take us into executive session until 7:55. Let's go. Okay, so it's 7:55 and we're back in session. City Manager, do you have a motion for us?
Yes, Mayor. If it pleases the council, we would ask for a motion authorizing the City of Mill Creek to pay Harbor Pacific Contractors Incorporated, also known as HPC, in the amount of $61,000, authorizing the city manager to effectuate a settlement agreement consistent therein.
So move.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Mike?
I think for clarification, so there's not a lot of mystery. This has to do with the 35th Avenue project, and it was a dispute about what the final work that was done. And the staff has done a great job of working on this, but it came down that it was reasonable for the contractor to be paid this last final amount, so that we're going to finish up that part of the contract.
Okay. Do you have anything to add?
No, Mayor.
Okay, so we have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Abstentions? Passes unanimously. If there's no other business this evening, tonight, we are adjourned. Thank you very much. Adjourned at 7:56.
Cool.